Well, thank you all for being here this evening. And, you know, I had a talk prepared that sort of followed on the talk I gave last time I was here. And I thought I might talk about what happened to Weka's suffering after he had his moment that we talked about last time. But then I was kind of refining that and practice and, you know, kind of preparing for this evening. And I realized that when I come here, you know, I speak in different places because my teacher is up at the Russian River Zendo, so I go different places and give talks. And this business of giving talks is quite challenging. You know, what will people want to hear? What will be useful to people that I can offer? Where are people now? Where am I now? I mean, there's all these questions in play. And but I realized that when I'm at home, when I'm here with my Sangha, with the people I live with, who have lived with me all these years, I really always want to be right on the edge of my practice. I want to be talking to you about where I am today, not where I was yesterday. So I wrote a new talk, and I'm feeling a little edgy about it. But, you know, let's give it a whirl and see if this is useful to you. If it is not useful to you, I'm sorry.
Let it wash, like the water.
Let it wash, yeah, like the waves of a thousand oceans from your ears. Anyway, so hopefully you'll find a little something in it. So the question I've started to work with is, what's it like to live a life that's not worth living? And it's an edge for me, so I can't tell you that I have an answer to this question. But I think it's a compelling personal koan. What's it like to live a life that's not worth living? And as most of you know, I work with a lot of emotional pain. That really is my Dharma gate. And I also have chronic physical pain that I've had for 15 or 20 years. So pain has been a powerful teacher for me and will always, for my entire life, be a powerful teacher for me. I'm still trying to go through the door. I'm not convinced there's an other side there, but I'm just still trying to go through the door and pay attention while I'm walking through the door. Not just on one side or the other side, but actually the process of the feeling and the sensations of going through the door. But in thinking about this question of a life worth living, you know, there's so many ways to go with this question. And that's why it's so rich for me. But I think really we, you know, this question, it's probably not a question of worth. And so it's a misleading question to begin with. Is living life a question of a life worth living? I'm thinking not so much. I'm thinking we are living. It's not a question of living the life. The life is living itself. And so I would reframe it slightly to say, what would it mean to live a worthy life? And so, you know, Zen has some kind of, or Buddhism has some answers to that or some ideas about that, about living, you know, about Shila and ethics and precepts and, you know, right livelihood and all the things that we hear about, read about in our practice. And those are all beautiful things. And I think probably it's hard to live a worthy life without paying attention to our ethics and the choices we make in our lives. But my sense for me is that my body, and I, by the way, I have no clock here. My body knows, my body feels when I am living a life that is worthy. My body feels when I am living a life worth living. And as someone who really works with a lot of pain, I can tell you that the one thing that determines a life not worth living is a life being chased or running from pain. or pleasure. That actually being dragged around by pain or by pleasure are both tremendous sources of suffering. And neither creates a life worth living. Because the problem with it is it always catches me, always. I can run, but I cannot hide. And that really is true. So ultimately, it will catch up with me, and I will have to turn and just sit with what's actually there, or my best idea of what's actually there. So I want to share with you a story, because this is a Zen center. Got to have a good story. So the master and the student are walking in the forest. And they're just enjoying a leisurely stroll in the forest, you know. And, you know, I think I've said this before. I'll say it here again because it just amazes me. Enlightenment never happens in Zazen. It happens on walks in the forest or in the dining room or some, you know, weird thing. Rarely. I mean, I think Dogen, right, had his Kensho experience in Zazen. Okay, that's Dogen. For the rest of us, it happens like this. So the master and the student are walking along, and the student says to the master, "You know, I noticed that when you get near, when you approach, the animals run. You know, the squirrels run, the rabbits run, the raccoons run, even the snakes, you know, they run. And so why is that? Why are all these beings trying to get away from you?" And the master said, "Because they know I'm a killer." And this story really speaks to me about my life and a life worth living, so that I see that, first of all, probably a life worth living includes being real about what I really am, you know, being sort of being inclusive of the whole of me, which includes that I'm a killer. And so there are many ways that I feel I, quote, kill. One is that I think, when I study it, probably about 90% of what I experience has nothing to do with what's actually happening. Now, this is frightening to me. So this is where this gets edgy for me. I do think, truthfully, when I look long and hard at the way I take in information, how I interpret information, what my body does with information is probably the truest. But then immediately it gets filtered through my karmic stream. It drowns really in my karmic stream, to tell you the truth. Probably about 90% of my body can receive drowns in my karmic experience, my memory, my karmic knots, so to speak. And so essentially, you know, I'm killing that 90% of what is. I'm not able to really take it just as it is. I make it something different. I've had many dramatic examples of this, which I have shared with some of you who know me well. These are not things I'm proud of as I talk about them or experience them. But I do try to experience them out loud, so that everyone, as much as possible, who's around me can see the suffering here and maybe be more skillful than I am able to be sometimes. But, you know, one example of this that I've talked about with some of you and actually found myself apologizing for is that sometimes I tend to hear things as... I tend to receive things as if I were being victimized when I'm not. So I tend to just expect, in a sense, because of my experience and my karmic stream, as well as my memory in this lifetime, that my brain expects to be rejected and to be challenged, not to be just received and loved, but to be judged and criticized. That's what my mind expects in the world. So even today, at 51, I go into the world with that lens. All five skandhas, right? Everything about me goes into the world with that lens. So it's not uncommon for me to feel wronged or belittled or criticized, when that isn't at all what's happening. So essentially, I have killed with my mind, with my my mental inflexibility, my mental habits, a huge amount of my of what I could be receiving. So essentially, these tremendous gifts are being offered to me, and I can't see them. I can't receive them because I'm not sure if they're gifts. I think, what's she trying to do? What's going on here? This is where my mind goes. My mind becomes suspicious. My mind starts to question it. Or I actually feel hurt when someone has expressed a desire to help me. I feel embarrassed or shamed by my weakness that I would require help. I mean, so I'm really just sort of showing you a little slice of this suffering mind. But this mind, essentially, you know, this 90% is my area, my vast area of delusion. I am deluded. Sawaki Roshi said, I am so deluded. I am deluded with gold edges. And that's what I know about myself. I know that to be true. Because that's that 90% of my of the world, of the true nature of the world, of what is really happening here, I cut off from my taking it in. And I'm talking about it like it's really volitional, like I'm saying, "Oh, here it comes. I'm cutting it off." That's not it. It's very subtle. It's very nuanced. I've lived in the world, you know, half a century. I know how to look. So it's frequently not you know, what I take into the world when I can. But the fact is, it's always there, and I'm always doing this with my experience. So, and I think we all do this. So I'm talking about myself, but I think this is a universal experience. Maybe I think I do it more because that's part of my 90%. I'm better at being deluded than you are. But the fact is, I think this is what we all do. We all bring our memory, our history, our prior experience, our habits to this moment, and we kill off a percentage of the moment with that. And then hopefully with practice, we can increase the percentage of the moment that we can be present for and show up for. You know, that's, you know, I just really, what happens for me though in the midst of that 90% playing out is that I can't open my heart. I can't open my heart to what's actually happening. So in a sense, I'm frozen there. I want to open my heart. I want to be with you openly, wholeheartedly. I want to leave nothing out. But the reality is, I'm limited by what I can see and experience and actually receive. So and I, you know, I forgot that I wear bifocals. And I made the print really small on this. So here we go again. Can you read this for me? Just kidding. So the point being that in that 90%, when I kill 90% of the moment, I kill not just right the moment, but I kill all the beings in it. I kill including myself in that moment so that I can't show up here with my whole mind and heart. The 90% essentially blinds me to the 10%. Oh, Jean, thank you. Light! I even forgot to ask and I still got it. That might be better than God. Oh, that's part of the 90%. So, God had to ask, right? Isn't that biblical? God said there will be light, and there was light. I didn't even have to say that. See? Sangha, you guys, I'm telling you. Powerful, powerful, powerful thing. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for playing in my story with me. So this not being able to open my heart, I understand, keeps me in pain and prevents me from waking up. So I think most of the waking up experiences in Zen and in Buddhism in general, is my guess, are about opening the heart, actually. They're not about knowing something or figuring something out, or they're about opening the heart, about being completely open, open-hearted. And so I see that my memories, my karmic stream blinds me to that and makes it difficult for me to open my heart. So even if I've had, which in my nearly 20 years of practice, I have had some, you know, what I would call what seem to be sort of Kensho experiences or waking up experiences, in the next moment, I'm in the 90%. So perhaps what Weka said, and I talked last time about Bodhidharma and Weka, and Weka was Bodhidharma's disciple, and he was the second ancestor of Zen. He struggled himself with emotional pain or mental anguish, it's referred to as in the literature, and he had his awakening experience in an interaction with Bodhidharma. And then the question is, so what happens? You know, so now he has this experience where he sees his suffering for what it is. He sees that it's empty, that it has no existence outside of conditions that are also present. And in that instant, you know, he's relieved. It's described as his mind is pacified. So he is relieved of suffering. We can see that in the story. So what about the next moment after that? You know, is Weka a different guy? Does he get to show up from then on in Sangha as an enlightened being who's just, you know, unperturbed and equanimous? You know, does he look like a different person the day after, the moment after? I think he probably still has to contend with the 90%. I think the next moment is a new moment. And that's my experience. So Rick Fields, after enlightenment, the laundry, the carry wood, carry water. I think that's what that means. So, you know, I am a killer. And the creatures run when they see me coming. And I should know why that is. And I should honor them for their wisdom. And at the same time, the question of a life worth living for me is about refining consciousness. And the question really is, can I refine my consciousness through diligent practice, using the vast, field of tools and practices that my ancestors have laid before me over 2,500 years? Can I use those in my life today in a way that allows me to, number one, really understand what is so captivating to my mind? What is so captivating about this 90%? What is it in there? What is in that story that is so interesting to me? What is it that draws my mind? Is it that I think tragedy won't get its due? That somehow if I don't spend all my time focused on the tragedy, that it somehow won't get enough weight or attention or that it will get ignored or made little of? Or, you know, what is it about that 90%? I mean, I've literally walked in airports saying, okay, what is it about this? You know, what is it? What's so interesting? I'll be walking in the airport in San Jose, you know, is like multiple football fields now. If anyone has not been there, don't. But, I mean, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's modern. I can see you've been there. But, oh, wow, you know, whew, you gotta be ready to haul. So I was walking, doing my, you know, walk in the airport at 6 o'clock one morning. And I felt arise in my body a sense of panic. So I live with panic. Panic is my central emotion. You could call it terror. I call it panic because I think it's one step past terror. But anyway, so I feel this panic in my body. I feel it in my stomach. I feel it in my heart. My chest becomes heavy. I feel the upper part of my body change. And then my mind says, panic. There it is. I know this. This is familiar. And then it basically fills it all in for me. My mind fills it all in. Now, automatically, it has killed what's actually happening. I have no idea what's actually happening. What is happening is sensations in my body, which my mind has for many, many decades interpreted as panic. And it could be called that. That's a fair word for it. But what else is there? I don't know, because my consciousness is not refined enough. So when I was walking in the airport, I said, I'm going to actually step outside this. I'm going to pull my consciousness out of this sensation, and I'm going to be with the sensation, but I'm going to look at it instead of just going into it and saying, oh, I'm panicked, and look at me, and how awful, and whatever. So I stood outside it, and I looked at this process playing out in my body. And I watched it, and I asked myself the question, what is so interesting about this? What is it that when this sensation arises, it captivates me? It consumes me. It hijacks my mind, we could say. It takes me away and wants to consume every ounce of my mental energy. Why? What is it going on? So I don't know yet. I'll tell you later if I come up with an answer to that question. But the question itself really interested me, and I realized that if I could refine my consciousness enough that I could focus on that energy happening in my body, that sensation that I read as panic, and at the same time focus on the thousand other things that are going on in the room. I mean, I'm at an airport, okay? There's a lot of opportunity here to be interested in things outside myself. So can I both stay with my own pain? Because I don't want to abandon myself. That's not our practice. Our practice is to be with what is arising. But there's not only my physical sensations arising. There's also this whole world out here arising. The conditions here are also arising. I'm one of them. My sensations are part of the picture. But there's this whole thing happening. And my mind, literally, wants to hone in on this one thing, this one slice of the pie. And so it's very good at that. My mind is very good at focusing. I can focus. The problem for me is pulling out, having a bigger, being able to put that suffering on a bigger field and see it with all the conditions that are happening around it. When I'm able to do that, and I actually was able to do that day in the airport, and then, you know, I was like happy, and then I realized, oh, there's another delusion. So anyway, but let's not go to my next delusion. Let's stay with this one. So I realized, walking in the airport, you know, oh, I can look at that guy in the really, and it looks like Waldo, you know, with the red and white stripes, big wide red and white stripes. I'm like, fat woman would never wear that. You know, so now all of a sudden my mind is like, you know, my mind is now engaged with this world. And this pain in my gut, this panic, is like a radio playing in the room next door, right? It's no longer the blaring Bose stereo system, you know, that it was when it first arose. Because in some way I could see it, identify it, perhaps, and then rather than go with it, step witness it. I could put myself in the witness role. It could still be there. I could say, oh, you know, yeah, this is hard. I mean, it really hurts. I have to drag this around. It really is hard. But the life worth living comes in the capacity to simultaneously include more of my experience so that I'm not completely consumed with the 10%. with the emotion or the 90% that I'm interpreting about the world. Then sometimes I can actually, you know, see the 10%. The 10% would include things like Kathy standing up and coming over here to help me with my microphone when she sees me struggling. That's a 10%. That's a gift. She didn't have to do that. She made effort on my behalf. I guess on all our behalf, actually, because truthfully, I could have sat here for a long time and struggled with that. So thank you from all of us. But the point is, in that moment, I saw Kathy's gift. So that's the 10%, and I could see it. So I've been sitting this evening, and I was purposely sitting and practicing with broadening my consciousness, with not narrowing, but actually being with my suffering, which I'm feeling it right now, these panic sensations. But I want to be with you. So I'm now looking at you, and I'm with you fully. And my radio is still playing in the next room. But at least the beautiful 10% that's here with me I can be with simultaneously with that radio. Now, there is pain that cannot go to the next room, truthfully. We have all perhaps experienced in our lives pain that cannot be relegated to a lower volume. And I think that the life worth living in that kind of pain is to learn to trust the pain, actually. So that's another refinement of consciousness. I do think that if you have experienced pain, emotional pain or physical pain, that is so annihilating that there is no space for pleasure or joy in that moment or at that time. If you have experienced that, truthfully, I don't think you ever come back exactly the same way together again from that kind of pain. And I think it's a rich moment, actually. And the problem is, of course, it's very frightening. So we want to move away from it. But there's another famous story that's about this very thing, where a student, a monk, asks Yun Men, what happens when the tree withers and the leaves fall? Leaves fall off. And Yun Men said, body exposed in the golden wind. Body exposed in the golden wind. And I think that's what these moments are. These moments of just shocking, self-annihilating pain and suffering. Our body exposed in the golden wind. It is like wind buffeting your body. It's just hanging out there. You have no idea. I've been here, so I'm speaking from experience. I have no idea where this will end, if it will end, if it will ever change. I have no idea what's going to happen, what other people will do, what I may, you know, how I will feel, how I will be able to or not receive things with my heart and my mind. So all I can do is be exposed and feel the wind completely. That's all I can do in those moments. But what the teaching is in this story is that it's golden wind. In other words, it's hopeful wind. It has treasure in it. If we can learn to trust hanging there, if we can learn to trust hanging there, and that's our practice. We practice when we're not hanging there. So when we are hanging there, we can be there and receive the golden wind that doesn't always feel like gold. And sometimes it's not for years later that we look back and go, wow, that was really golden. You know, that moment was gold. It felt like a hell realm, but it was gold, right? So that's the paradox of our lives. And for me, that's the paradox of a life worth living. Is that A, it's not really about a life worth living, and B, that it really is probably mostly about training our mind so that when we are a body exposed in the golden wind, we can mine it and move that 90% to 89%, 88%, right? Nudge that back, trying to get that 10% a little bigger and a little bigger and a little bigger. But without attachment to that. Because body exposed in the golden wind isn't attached. It's just exposed there in the golden wind, not knowing. It's actually a not knowing place. So I think when you're in that kind of place, my encouragement is to come to Sangha. To ask for what you need, to come as you are. I keep saying that, it's my phrase, but to come as you are here and every place you go so that people can hold you, whether you can receive it or not. Okay. Kathy held me this evening with her help. I received it. Sometimes I have not been able to receive it. Kathy knows this. She has been the recipient of my non-receiving. So have many of you. And So that's, you know, that's part of the 90%. So I think if we can learn to stay with ourselves and with one another in these times, I think if we can train our minds, refine our minds enough that we can work with these, you know, this 90% maybe a little more skillfully, but without, but at the same time, paradoxically, trusting it. You know, Weka, when he, his most famous quote is, wisdom and ignorance are identical, he says. So wisdom and ignorance are identical, not different. This was his awakening. Wisdom and ignorance are identical. So we can see wisdom as the complete embracing of ignorance. So being in the 10% is completely embracing the 90%, saying, yes, here it is, as I am right here, still showing up, still being body exposed, being willing. And maybe it's bigger than, I mean, now as I talk about it with you, I think maybe it's bigger than any question of worth, and maybe it's really a question of vow. A question of what's most important to you. What are you willing to put out and say, this is who I am, and I'm going to live like this. This is very opposite of our societal norms, right, which are all about acquisition and racing around and acquiring and consuming. So it takes a lot of guts to step outside that and say, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be authentic, whether it's pretty or not, so that other people can learn from my suffering. Or I'm going to X, Y, Z, you know, whatever it is for you. I shared mine. You have yours. And so to really assert those values in our society is not an easy thing. But I think that maybe that's where I would go with a life, with a worthy life, and also a life worth living, is in the refinement of consciousness, the devotion to the 10%, and the recognition that in reality, the 90% is where I spend most of my actual time. That was a depressing ending. I was going for a good ending, but I kind of ended on I ended in the 90%, didn't I? Thank you. I'll shut up now. I might make it worse. Jean. Okay.
Back to the monk and student in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it, I think part of my question is this. It might be true that that monk and the student, by the way, in his company,
mm-hmm.
are killers.
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting that the student laid it all on the... Yeah, I do love that about their... Hey, by the way, when you approach, you know... And, you know, that's part of the 90% for all of us, is that we other it. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
It's the second part of it, that the animals themselves bring.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Bunnies are going to hop away from me whether I'm kind to them or not. Bunnies hop away from human beings because, in general, we're a threat to them. And so also is snakes and birds and whoever else we might meet in the mm-hmm. forest, including predators. Myself, I met mountain lion out in the hills, mm-hmm. and mountain lion, a predator, could take me down in a second, mm-hmm. but also shies away.
Mm-hmm.
So, the question really is, mountain lion, bunnies, birds, don't know that I'm a gentle soul. I am a killer, and I'm a gentle soul. I wouldn't hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
So the part of it that the animals themselves bring is their own karmic stream.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they do when humans are around. So part of it is personal. Here's the question then. Part of it is personal and part of it is not personal at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience in the airport for you, Wake's experience, it's very personal,
mm-hmm.
very individual to you. And also, it's just what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, in this kind of personal and impersonal.
Well, I think there are a lot of pieces to the story that you're bringing out that I didn't bring out. You know, and there is more to the story that I didn't include. You know, so they went on, they had some additional dialogue about it. I think they are talking, I mean, I think this koan, this story is talking about the 10% and the 90%. I think it's saying that even for the animals, you know, they're just reacting. They're reacting to sound and to their own sort of, we can't say beliefs, but their own experience or karmic understanding. And those are automatic reactions. They're just reacting. I mean, I grew up in Arizona where there were rattlesnakes, diamondbacks everywhere. And we had an outhouse. And my father didn't want to put a door on the outhouse, so his answer was to turn the outhouse so it didn't face the house. Okay? And then it was, you know, private. So in the middle of the night, you know, you get up to go to the outhouse, and then everybody just says, carry a stick and make a lot of noise, like move leaves, you know, make sure you make sound when you, because the snakes will go. They will be afraid of the sound. So they react to being scared. Being stepped on, you know, would be